The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. A 16-minute hat-trick, a million signatures in his fight to end child poverty. Is Marcus Rashford the greatest person alive? Better than Attenborough? Question mark. Manchester United put five past the Bundesliga leaders, so are they officially now good? And is Ole a tactical genius? Jamie Jackson's written a book about him, so he seems a good person to ask. And we'll try and spend more time talking about the game than Julian Nagelsmann's jacket. Elsewhere, Chelsea win 4-0 in Russia, and we'll round up all the other Champions League action. A disallowed hat-trick for Morata for Juve, and does Karim Benzema hate Vinicius Jr., or does he just not want to pass to him? It's all that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hello, Max. How was your mini break?
Oh, my mini break was spectacular. You had a day without me. Was it pleasant?
It was fine, yes. Where did you go on your mini break?
Went to Dorset.
Okay, I don't know where Dorset is.
It's on the south coast. Went to see Durdledor, which is a nice, it's sort of a bit of rock that goes out to the sea, but has like a doorway where the waves crash between it. It's beautiful.
Oh, I have seen that. That's where kids go tombstoning even.
Yes, I didn't do that.
Yeah, good.
No. Archie Rintutt joins us from Germany. Hello.
Hello.
You've been on the water slide, but we'll get to that later. Lars Sivertsen, hello.
Hi, Max.
And you have written a book, Jamie Jackson, and it's almost criminal that we haven't had you on the pod yet. But do you only come on the pod when you've got something to flog? Is that how it works?
Yeah, it kind of basically is. I've always got a few wares ready to be peddled.
It's just a big jacket, and you open it, and there's books and watches and everything.
I'm looking forward to this. I have actually been on this show a couple of times before. Now, Barry might not remember this, but during Euro 2008, you had it set up, I think, in Vienna, and I came and did it there. Do you remember that, Barry?
We were in the Gusser Beer Clinic, a room above a pub.
Yes.
With lots of antlers on the walls, but no yes. No ISDN line. We sent some of our best men to scope out, do a recce in Vienna. They spent 2 weeks there and came up with a room that didn't have an ISDN line. But yeah, Jamie, there is a lot about Euro 2008 that I don't remember, due in no small part to the fact that we were based in a pub.
Did the beer clinic cure you of your ills?
Oh, cured me of all that ailed me.
Right, let's get on with it. Then Manchester United 5, RB Leipzig 0. Marcus Rashford, a hat-trick in 16 minutes. He didn't even demand to take the penalty when he'd scored two, but let Martial take it so he could have a goal. William says, can we retire the phrase, he needs to concentrate on his football now, please? Barry, is there nothing this man can't do?
Well, he's just a saint, a living saint. He's feeding the hungry. He's scoring goals for Manchester United, getting Ole Gunnar Solskjaer out of a jam. After the game, his first tweet wasn't about his hat-trick, but it was about the petition he has online and how it passed, I think, a million signatures. And he also tweeted, and I don't know if he was gently trolling his detractors or genuinely didn't know. He asked, in all seriousness, what does virtue signalling mean? So that's a question I had to ask Barney Ronay last year at some point, and he thought I was joking, but I honestly didn't know. So I don't know if Marcus Rashford knows or not, but there was no shortage of people queuing up to tell him that virtue signalling is something that people with sociopaths with no empathy accuse people who are nice of doing.
To this point, Barry, when I remember you decided to take on Tom Moore in quite the contrarian position during lockdown. And I'm just wondering I was thinking if there's anyone who could come up with a Marcus Rashford isn't that nice, it would be the man who said this 100-year-old walking around his garden to raise money for charity isn't all that.
Well, Marcus Rashford has done a lot more than just walk around his back garden. And if Tom Moore scores a Champions League hat-trick, I am prepared to concede that I was wrong about him and that he's not a charlatan.
Lars, it was classic centre-forward finishing from Rashford, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And I mean, we're going to get on. This is going to be a Solskjaer-heavy pod, I guess. But I think now,
It seems obvious now, but it is easy to forget that that was one of Solskjaer's sort of big ideas when he was brought in, is that, you know, from day one, Marcus Rashford, you're my guy. And that seems like a completely obvious thing to have done now, but it really wasn't then. And I think, obviously, the person who deserves the most credit for this is Marcus Rashford, but it is worth noting that he has a manager there who has supported him just 100% from day one, whereas, you know, you can think of quite a few other Man United managers who wouldn't.
Jamie, does Rashford want to... Does he want to ultimately play out of the middle, or does he want to come off the left?
I think he's off the left, but I mean, to a certain extent, I don't know, it's just semantics, isn't it? Because, you know, they float around across that front line. That's the idea. But yeah, no, it was a surprise that, because when he first broke into the team, it was kind of, you know, maybe by default, a couple of people were injured, but he was a centre forward. And I was surprised when I learned that he'd preferred to come in off the left. But I think it works quite well because Martial, you know, he hasn't got his scoring going yet, but he's become more of a kind of muscular, direct centre forward. He doesn't lose the ball with those runs that he goes on. You know, he's very effective now. But yeah, it's interesting because the word was when Jadon Sancho was due to arrive, or they thought they were going to get him, that the one under threat actually was Rashford. So, you know, there'd be then four of them with Greenwood as well. And Greenwood sort of rated the number one. And Rashford was maybe the one who was under threat if that happened. Of course, you know, they rotate, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, he has a very interesting capacity to surprise. And so, you know, who knows where that one would go. You almost now look at that and think, well, do they actually need Sancho?
Yes.
They do. Is that the answer? you tweeted out that this was the worst performance of Nagelsmann's tenure. I was thinking, well, the last time I saw Leipzig really was when they absolutely annihilated Spurs. I know Leipzig are really good. Mm-hmm. I know they've lost a couple of players, but was this Manchester United being great, or was this Leipzig being really bad, or you know, one begets the other, right?
I can tell you that in the post-match interviews, it was not, well, we've come up against an incredible Manchester United side. That was very much not the vibe from Julian Nagelsmann and Leipzig. It was more that they'd shot themselves in the foot. And it's the worst I've ever seen any Julian Nagelsmann side play before. He didn't reckon with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer going with a midfield diamond. And I think that his side didn't press well enough either. You look at key performers in that side who are the backbone of it. Deo Upamecano, for example, the next much vaunted central defender that everybody wants next summer, following hot in the footsteps of Matthias de Ligt, Kalidou Koulibaly, and a lot of others. He had a bad game. And Marcel Sabitzer, their captain, who's coming back from injury, was always going to be a case that he could only play a certain amount of minutes. But he was responsible for giving away the penalty and giving away the ball for one of Marcus Rashford's goals as well. So Nagelsmann said that after the tactical switch he made in the first half, going from a 3-5-2, switching to a 4-2-3-1, he was like, well, United didn't get into our half once after that. But the point is, what happened in the second half, Julian? Because it was a very bad night for Leipzig. The worst defeat in their 11-year history.
All 11 years of it. Wow. Mm. Ryan said, are you's going to give Ole a bit of credit? Thrashing the team top of the Bundesliga, who are managed by one of the most highly rated coaches in the world. I mean, it is, Barry, quite a turnaround from the, you know, when Spurs hammered them 6-1.
Yeah, he deserves plenty of credit for the way he set the team up, for his substitutions, for the margin of victory. And I'm happy to give it to him. A lot of Manchester United fans are getting stuck into critics of Ole, but he is manager of Manchester United. The standards are supposed to be high. And the fact of the matter is, when he was being criticised, he probably deserved criticism because they finished 33 points behind Liverpool last season. They finished 15 points behind Man City. And in their first few league games in this season, they did not play well. That happened. But now that they're doing well, they thrashed Newcastle, they beat PSG, drew with Chelsea and hammered Leipzig, he deserves credit. That's how it works.
Lars, your hand is up. How polite.
It is, because I think Solskjaer, if you are one of the people who see it as just completely binary, and you know, a manager is either good or bad, he's doing well or terribly, then Solskjaer's reign at United will flummox you, because it is slightly confusing, because they have consistently throughout his time there, they've set up well and done well against stronger opponents, but they also keep, you know, failing in very familiar ways against supposedly weaker opponents in games where they're expected to dominate possession and control the game. And that is something they need to work on. But I do think, you know, whatever you make of Solskjaer, whether you think he was overpromoted or underqualified when he was put in charge, and all, there is debate there. But just empirically, while he's been there, United have consistently been set up in a way that works against these, you know, tougher opponents they come up against. That is something he keeps getting right. So we maybe shouldn't be surprised at this point that in these sort of slightly harder games, he does get it right. The question is, and remains, you know, Palace at home, these sort of games, you know, can they consistently win those? And they're not going to challenge for the title until they do. And that is something that's going to, you know, keep following around that criticism. But at this point, he does do very well in these games.
Dan says, Nagelsmann's suit's got to be worth a couple of minutes on the pod, at least. Mocha Lang says, anyone else look at Nagelsmann and immediately think Bertie Wooster? Anyone else think, where's Jeeves to talk you out of your fruitier sartorial stylings? Nagelsmann spoke to Sky Germany afterwards, Archie, didn't he? He didn't seem that excited to talk about his... I don't know how you describe his jacket. Not very nice is what springs to mind. Nagelsmann said, don't talk so much about my clothes. I wear what I like. I'm a football coach, not a model.
That's very much the problem, though, isn't it? There's a friend of mine, Thomas Hay, on Twitter, who says, I'm starting to see a trend in Nagelsmann's dressing. In the Bundesliga, middle management at work. Champions League, middle manager at the Christmas party. which I think is right on.
Is that fair, Archie?
He's got great range to his wardrobe. I'd have to say that much. But this is now the second time in a big Champions League game where he's worn something a little more extravagant by, let's say, the tastes of football and
humans.
It's crucially humans. Yeah, exactly. I mean, against PSG, I remember he wore that very tight fitting number as well, which made him stand out. But it's not great when you come off that kind of heavy defeat, and that's what you've been wearing. And I remember actually speaking to a Bundesliga coach last season off the record who was saying that sometimes Nagelsmann needs to remember that it's not about him. And I think that there is an element of it where when you do dress like this for such a big game, it is kind of, is it virtue signaling? I think it might be.
I'm really conscious of not just talking about, you know, laughing at clothes people wear, because in my experience of ex-professional footballers, the first thing they say to anybody, regardless of what they're wearing, is they sort of look at them and go, where'd you get those trousers from? Stupid trouser land, and then hope that everyone around them bursts out laughing.
Sort of, which ex-player said that to you?
I'm not going to name names, Lars, but many, I would say. There are some where it's just instant go-to. Whereas Ray Parler's instant go-to is when, if you're holding your cycle helmet in the office, he says, "How you getting home?" just on loop. Cycling, Ray.
They actually had a discussion about it on Sky's coverage last night in Germany. And Stefan Freund was saying, well, look, if you're going to dress like that, then you are going to, I think it's acceptable to have to answer questions on it. And Didi Hamann was saying, well, yes, but we do have to remember that gossip is much more of a thing in England than it is in Germany. And I think that that is also part of it. And this is something that will play a role in Julian Nagelsmann's career should he continue it abroad, is he needs to get used to this kind of noise around him. He's not had this level of scrutiny at Leipzig when he wears something a little bit more outlandish, so shall we say. I think we know that football is a bit more conservative in terms of its choices when it comes to fashion. So when anyone wears anything which is slightly colourful or a little bit different, then everybody's going to jump on it. But I think maybe this is part of the lesson for him of realising that, you know, when he's on the big stage and he wears something like this, that it will
attract more scrutiny than perhaps his tactics will.
Daniel says, what kind of managerial fashion would the panel opt for on a touchline? I'd say that Baz would 100% be monogrammed tracksuit wearer, BG in big letters, Wilson a tailored suit, Rushton the Owen Coyle shorts and tracksuit top. Do you have a do you have any monogrammed clothes, Barry?
No, I don't. I'm baffled by this. It's just a jacket. Yeah. I mean, it's not like he turned up dressed like a Russian Cossack or wearing skin-tight leather trousers or something.
Fair enough. Our producer Jack says, yeah, the amount of air, Loro's shirt banter, the amount of airtime wasted on the shirt that Mark Lawrenson has chosen to wear. But look, we're as guilty as anyone else, aren't we, Barry? You're probably right. Also on that group, PSG won 2-0 at Istanbul. Bazaksa here. Two for Moise Keane, and that is nice for him, Lars, isn't it?
4 goals in 2 games now for Moise Keane, admittedly against Dijon and Başakşehir. And I do think playing as centre forward for PSG is sort of not the toughest gig in showbiz. I mean, you do get a fair amount of chances up there, but there is clearly a very talented player there. Just as evidently as, you know, the fact that he sort of lost his way at Everton and that really didn't work out. But for him, I think playing, you know, regularly up front for a team that creates a lot of chances, that must be good for his confidence. And, you know, hopefully we can see more of it.
While we've got you, Archie, let's do the other German side who played last night. Dortmund beat Zenit 2-0. It was quite wet, wasn't it? Jadon Sancho scored a penalty. Erling Braut Haaland got one. Before the game, Lucien Favre blamed Sancho's indifferent start to the season on the Manchester United transfer saga. Would you say he's back on form? And is he over that, do you think?
The thing with Dortmund right now is you look at the players that they have in that side, and on paper they're a lot more exciting than they are to watch in person. You look at the attacking talent that they have, and it seems like they're a bit constrained. That said, at the back they are more solid than I can remember them being in the last few years. Roman Bürki's not had to make a save in their last two games now since coming back, and Lucien Favre has been switching around the goalkeepers recently. He's put Marvin Hitz in goal a couple of times. And the favourite pastime of any reporter in Germany right now is trying to pin Lucien Favre down to say, who's your number one goalkeeper? And Favre every time is like, I've had this discussion. I don't need to answer this. So he's frustrating quite a lot of people with that in Germany. But yeah, with Sancho, I think we have to remember he's 20. I think he's allowed a little bit of a dip. And I think you can imagine with the amount of hype that was going on around him this summer that it would have been difficult to concentrate for him. I think he'll come back and still have a good season. But yeah, he's in a little bit of a rough patch, but not enough for me to, I would say, doubt the extraordinary talent that he has.
Yeah, I think watching this game, it must have felt very familiar for Erling Haaland. You know, this sort of rain growing up in the southwest of Norway, very much, except in Norway, it would have been sideways entirely, this rain. It would have come at you from the side, not so much the top. Archie, while you're here, the Lucien Favre thing is slightly odd to me because he's a manager who I think most people sort of respect and think he's quite good. Mm-hmm. But also, I think you'll really struggle to find anyone who thinks he's the guy who will take Dortmund where they want to go. It's in this sort of weird situation now where he's liked and respected, but most people think he should leave. But maybe not right now at the end of the season. That's a slightly eerie situation to be in with a manager, no?
It is, and it feels like Dortmund haven't really moved forward that much under him either. It feels like he's more of an artist as a coach, and that doesn't really fit with this Borussia Dortmund image at all. Borussia Dortmund are meant to be, I would say, more active and more proactive in the way that they attack games, and that's not really been the case. You look at the way that in an opening half an hour of a game, Bayern Munich try and absolutely annihilate their opponents. And Borussia Dortmund, it takes them time always to get into the game. And always hear Lucien Favre when he's asked what could the side have done better after the game, it's always like, oh, well, I think we needed to be a little bit more patient, which I think can also be another way of saying, well, they needed to trust in my plans a little bit more and keep doing it. He's not necessarily the guy for a plan B, I would say, but you know, the way that his sides have always outscored the expected goals and always seem to overperform from the chances that they get, tells you that there is something there. And his combination play, he left a long shadow at Borussia Mönchengladbach, which only now Marco Rosa is the first coach to step out of. However, Lucien Favre himself is in a much bigger shadow at Borussia Dortmund, and that is, of course, the shadow of Jurgen Klopp. And getting out of that, I think, is going to be a continual issue for Dortmund in the coming years.
Jamie, can I ask you a question about the Jadon Sancho saga and just sort of how tedious or interesting you find having to cover that as a, you know, the Manchester football correspondent for The Guardian? And if you're under any pressure to, you know, get the story before anyone else, or can you just go, do you know what? Is this just going on forever? Can't I just wait until it happens, if it happens, and then report on it?
As in, Jamie, was it more or less tedious than that time you had to cover Portsmouth going in and out of administration twice a week for 3 months?
Well, you know, both stories, Portsmouth and Sancho, had hilarious moments. And this is the best thing about reporting. A lot of the stuff, actually, you can't really report, but you kind of think is true, or, you know, it's certainly got some sort of value to it. But it does get a bit tedious. Then again, it doesn't. I mean, the pressure to answer that part of it, Max, is just to get it right. So, you know, you've got to get it right, really. So there's no rush to do something if just to do something, which is good, because I'm not sure not every other media organisation operates that way. That's what I put it that way. But, you know, so Portsmouth was a good example, actually, because Sancho ended up being like this, where I was hearing it from all sides of the story. So that's agent and both clubs. And some of the stuff that is said about the other entities, basically the opponent in this deal, it gets quite hilarious. There's all sorts of things flying around about what United had or hadn't done, what Dortmund were trying to do, what the agent was demanding, what Sancho was up to, all sorts of PRs, grifters, shakers, spivs. You know, you start to hear from them and it all becomes kind of right up my street, really. I like all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it's just good fun, really. It'd be interesting to see what happens going forward, because I think Liverpool are after him. I think that's, you know, once Liverpool start getting involved the way they are at the moment, you know, and that would really, if you think Twitter... If you think Twitter is upset with United not getting Sancho now, wait till Twitter finds out Liverpool might be in for him.
I'm also in that group. Bruges 1, Lazio 1. Simon Mignolet versus Pepe Reina in the weren't quite good enough for Liverpool derby. Bruges should have won this game, but Lazio get a point despite having to leave 12 players behind with COVID. Patrick, who gave away the penalty, had to come off with nausea. The manager, Simone Inzaghi, praised his side for bringing out everything they had within them amid 1,000 difficulties. He had 12 first-team outfield players to choose from. The day after, Archie, how I mentioned Gladbach feeling after... letting in those two late goals to Real Madrid?
Sore. Still a little bit sore, I think, because that would have been such a big win for them, particularly having thrown away a win in a not too similar disposition in Milan against Inter, albeit I think this is from a slightly greater height now. But it shows the steps that the team has taken to be throwing away or at least being on the same eye level as sides like Inter and Real, the steps forward that Gladbach have taken in this past decade. And sporting director Max Eberl deserves a lot of credit for that in terms of his recruitment. And it shows you that if you have everybody pushing in the same direction and following what has been his plan at the same club, then that is something that just has to be there if you are going to be a major club competing at the top level. So his appointment of Marco Rosa, getting hold of him when there was a lot of competition, I think has been an astute acquisition. But the funny thing is, I don't think we've seen Gladbach even really play that well yet. I think in the second half against Real, they were slowly growing into confidence a little bit more. But yeah, I think Alassane Player, even though he was involved in the first two goals, he will still be seeing that chance that he had to make it 3-0 over and over again right now.
Finally, Archie, you've been on the water slide. So that's how was it?
It was good. I was a bit nervous going down it the first time because there's a fault with the stop and the go sign, meaning that I had this mother and child following me down at quite a pace, and I was a little bit worried that I was going to get hit. But after that, I went up and had another go, and I got a bit more speed there and, yeah, thoroughly enjoyed it. Would recommend.
Archie, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Archie Rintel, they're out in Germany, and that'll do for part one. Part two will begin in Krasnodar. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, on Monday, the 9th of November at 7:30 p.m., we are doing our first official Guardian Football Weekly live show where you do not have to leave your house. It will be me, Barry, Jonathan Wilson and Barney Ronay. It costs £6 and we would all love to see you there. I'll tweet out links. I'm tweeting them out on a far too regular basis. But yeah, click on the link and come along. The last one, as someone said, they thought it would be shit, but actually it was okay. So look, we're aiming for that. Please come along. Krasnodar 0, Chelsea 4. Anyone else think this wasn't really a 4-0, 4-0? I thought Chelsea made quite hard work of it until later on. They had a similar game against Palace where it was 4-0, but it really could have gone either way for 50 odd minutes, Lars.
But I think that's kind of where Chelsea are at the moment. I mean, they look slightly undercooked as a team, but there's so much attacking talent in that lineup that if you can just not concede a ton of goals, they'll probably find some goals for you somewhere. And they're so good if you look at some of those names going forward there. And it does make you think that if Frank Lampard can make those forward players function as a unit, which, I mean, to be fair to him, he's had a lot of new players thrown at him with not a lot of time to work on with them on the training ground so far. So we should temper our criticism a little bit, I think. If he can make it work with them going forward, they should just be an absolutely ferocious team. And yeah, I'm quite big on Chelsea.
What'd you make of it, Baz?
Yeah, I suppose I'd be inclined to agree with your opinion. It wasn't really a 4-0, 4-0, but that's a sentiment that will no doubt earn you pelters from Chelsea's support who think we're out to get Frank Lampard. And indeed, Frank Lampard, who thinks we're all out to get Frank Lampard, despite the fact that he's the most overpraised coach in English football. But again, another clean sheet, and they scored four goals. So you can't really fault it. Away from home, and they had to travel a long way.
Hakim Ziyech is a wonderful player, isn't it? And he looked good. I know this seems like such an obvious thing to say, Jamie, but Mendy is just so much better than Kepa. It just looked like everything he exudes calm, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, he is now effectively third choice, is he, Kepa, at Chelsea? So he's gone from, what was he? Was he 70, 75 million? You know, it was a lot of money. And yeah, as I say, he's now third choice. And I tell you what, talk about being backed, you know, Lampard as the coach, the manager of Chelsea, sort of saying, yeah, I'm going to drop this guy because, you know, the value obviously goes like that. You know, you can kiss goodbye to a massive chunk of that 70 million, yeah, or however much it cost him. Which leads me on to saying he's got to do something half special this season, Lampard, because he's been backed. He's been there a season. He's got all these players in. Okay, they had a transfer ban, so they're playing catch-up. But, you know, it is his squad now, a bit very much like Solskjaer at United. So let's see if he can do it. I saw the Chelsea United game. Both sides stunk it out. I wasn't able to see yesterday because I was on the way to Old Trafford, but obviously kept track of it. And yeah, I don't know. Let's see how he goes. I'm not so sure. I don't know if he's already. The difference between him and Solskjaer is Solskjaer knows or seems to understand that whether he wants to or not, it's better to be smooth, charming, urbane before characters like myself and everyone else here rather than everyone's out to get me, as you just alluded to. I don't think it's a great strategy.
Roman Abramovich was there. Frank Lampard said he didn't manage to speak to him. Just wonder if you'd think, there aren't that many opportunities for me to speak to. Why didn't he come and see me? I would get, be like, if the boss was in the office and I didn't, you know, walk past you and didn't say something to you, I'd instantly think that is it for me. No chance.
More specifically, if the boss wasn't allowed or couldn't come to the country you're in and you are in a country where the boss is and he doesn't speak to you, that seems even a stretch further, no?
A combined score for the week, by the way, Premier League 14, rest of Europe 0. So conclusive proof there that the Premier League is the greatest league in the world. Also in Chelsea's group, Sevilla beat Rennes 1-0. Lovely finish from Luke de Jong there. In group G, Barca won 2-0 at Juve. Morata with three disallowed goals. That was fun, wasn't it? Dembele scored the first for Barca. Wonderful first-time pass from Messi. It was deflected. And then Messi got a penalty after Bernardeschi kicked Fatty over. And his teammates looked very, very disappointed. I don't know what to make of Barcelona at all. I know you talked about it a lot yesterday because there's quite a lot happening over there, but actually quite a crucial win for them, really, Lars.
Yeah, it was, and it's important to remember with Barcelona, even if they are a hot mess off the pitch. I mean, they still have some half good players on the pitch, and it kind of worked really well for them in this game. I really enjoyed Michael Owen, actually, of all people, in the BT studio talking about Alvaro Morata, because I think the presenter was trying to goad him into having a sort of VAR discussion. But Owen, of course, being a former striker of some renown, was more interested in talking about Morata's movement and how he keeps running offside for no particular reason. I mean, they were all clear offsides. And to quote the great Mark Owen, use your loaf. Yeah, you need to use your head. Use your loaf, I think, as a foreigner in these lands. Not heard that phrase before. Alvaro Morata, a man who needs to use his loaf. I mean, it's very good.
It'd be quite a perfect loaf. You imagine if Morata's, if the bread Morata made was similar to the perfect style of his hair.
Yeah.
It would be, but it would be, it wouldn't be, yeah, it wouldn't be an artisan loaf. It would be absolutely sort of factory made. Samuel says, is this tweet the worst thing to ever happen in football? Barry, Barcelona tweeting, we were glad you were able to see the goat emoji on the pitch at Juve. Kissy emoji with a picture of Lionel Messi, obviously referring to the fact that Cristiano couldn't be on the pitch.
Well, I thought it was quite funny. I would imagine lots of Juve fans got very upset about it. But, I got a chuckle out of it.
Juventus replied, you probably looked it up in the wrong dictionary. We'll bring you the right one at Camp Nou.
Oh, God.
I mean...
That's Robin Lewandowski, isn't it?
It needs to end. I'm sorry. I hate to be like the sort of the sort of boomer in the group, but listen, well, official club accounts doing banter on Twitter just needs to end. It's so bad.
Cristiano Ronaldo made his feelings towards coronavirus testing clear. He had the PCR test, polymerase chain reaction test, a common form of COVID-19 testing, taken within a swab or a saliva sample. He wrote, PCR is bullshit. So there you are. So if you're getting one of them, listen to Cristiano, obviously. Also in that group, Ferencvaros 2, Kiev 2. Nostalgic to see fans in the stadium and great to see them celebrate. Ferencvaros came back from 2 goals down. The second goal was 3 people had shots that were basically going wide, and eventually someone went to another player and eventually went in. Lars?
We were quite excited about this in Norway because Ferencvaros' player, Tokmak Nguyen, who scored the first goal, he's got an interesting background. His mum's from Ethiopia. His father is from what is now South Sudan, and he was born in Kenya, but he moved to Norway at the age of 5. So we definitely consider him one of us, and we're kind of hoping he gets picked for the national team because he's been really good in the Hungarian league and was good against Celtic, it was, in the playoffs, wasn't it? And he scored now in the Champions League proper, and Norwegian TV got him on FaceTime from the dressing room after the game because I guess they didn't have a reporter out there, so they got him up on FaceTime. And so he appeared to be almost like hiding from the manager, and the presenter was being very helpful and saying, you must hide from Rebrov. He's very strict, the presenter was telling him, and that's probably wise for Toki to stay away from. Yeah, very sporting of him to go on TV on FaceTime from the dressing room after the game. I want to see more of that.
That's great. A clip has surfaced from Tuesday night's games, from the Real Madrid game, of Karim Benzema telling Ferland Mendy not to pass to Vinicius Jr. at halftime during the game against Borussia Mönchengladbach. Quote, brother, don't play it to him. On my mother's life, he is playing against us. Barry, this is tremendous, isn't it?
Yeah, I was really shocked to see that. And then I went back to look at the highlights to see if they did sort of not pass to him, but it was hard to reach a conclusion really on limited amount of highlights. But the one thing I would say is that I thought Vinicius Jr. was one of Real Madrid's best players in their game against Barcelona at the weekend, so he was certainly playing for them at that game.
Who was it? There was an Arsenal player. Was it Ramsey or someone? Someone started a rumour that Ramsey and someone else wouldn't pass to each other. And I forget who the other one was. I love this idea of that level. They're all just humans. Well,
beautiful, really, because it's the sort of thing you get in the schoolyard. You know, yeah. I don't like this guy. Forget about him. He's useless or whatever it is. But we're looking at the highest level in Real Madrid. And it's just that what I liked about it as well is how much Benzema wanted to convince that he meant what he said. You know, I swear on my mother's life. Really, really, you know, go into the nth degree here to sort of make it known that he genuinely thought that, that a teammate was out to sort of, you know, puddle their performance, if I can put it that way. So yeah, a very beautiful moment in Planet Football.
Ramsey and Alexis Sanchez, apparently. Yes, no, it is like, it's sort of like Sunday League where a gaffer says, let's play it out from the back. And everyone goes, yeah. And then when they get on the pitch, you go, just hit the channels, lads. Now in the Europa League, Arsenal play Dundalk. Ollie says, I'd honestly just love to hear Barry talking about Dundalk for a bit. Always interesting to hear about the Irish League. I sent this to you, Barry, and you thought I wanted to hear you say this. I don't mind what you talk about. It's always lovely to hear you talk about anything, Barry, but... Anyway, Ollie would like to hear you talk about Dundalk in your twee, wispy Irish lilt.
Well, I could do it in a Dundalk accent and no one would want to hear that. But
I think you'll find a lot of people want to hear that.
Dundalk is, it's Steve Staunton territory. Steve Staunton's from Dundalk. It's a town in the smallest county in Ireland, County Louth. And they used to be managed by Stephen Kenny, who's now in charge of the Republic of Ireland. They won three consecutive league titles under him, qualified for the Europa League group stages. I think they won one, drew one, lost the rest. And then in 2018, they were taken over by this organization called Peak Six Sports, who used to own a 25% stake in Bournemouth, actually. And their manager was a fella... The guy who took over from Stephen Kenny was his assistant, Vinnie Purse. And I think the players didn't warm to Vinnie too much. And the owners, one of the guys behind Peak Six Sports, his father was kind of running the club from the USA. And he was, there was talk that he was telling Vinnie Purse what players he had to pick. There was talk he wanted a phone line installed in the dugout so he could ring in and suggest changes. So despite winning the league and cup last year, Vinnie Perth was sacked when Dundalk were beaten in the Champions League qualifiers this summer. And his job was offered to Robbie Keane, who turned it down. It was offered to various other people who turned it down. And eventually they appointed this Italian guy called Filippo Giovagnoli. So he's the interim head coach and has been since August. He'd never managed a senior team before. He'd only ever run sort of academies. He'd run AC Milan summer camps for schoolboys. And he was in charge of an academy in the Queens area of New York when he got this gig. And his assistant is a fella called Giuseppe Rossi. Not that one.
Oh.
No. But... they navigated their way through Europa League qualifiers. They're quite easy games, like the B teams from Andorra, Moldova and the Faroe Islands to qualify for the group stages. This has earned Dundalk a guaranteed windfall of €3 million, which for a team in the League of Ireland is an absolute fortune. But they haven't been doing particularly well in the League of Ireland this season. Shamrock Rovers have just won it with a couple of games to spare, I think. Dundalk are in third place. And tonight they play Arsenal. And going on ability and form, Arsenal should absolutely hockey them. But who knows? But it would be a dream come true for many of these players to play at the Emirates. And it's just a shame for them that there won't be any people there to watch it.
Thank you, Barry. Spurs go to Antwerp. Rangers play Lech Poznan, AEK, Leicester, Lille, Celtic in the Europa League, which is just very hard for the pod to cover, given when it happens and when we broadcast. So,
and given the fact that by Thursday, I just need a day off from football.
Absolutely right. So look, there are plenty of other reputable outlets where you can find out the scores. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll talk about Jamie Jackson's book, The Red Apprentice, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, The Making of Manchester United's Great Hope. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Jamie, you've written a book. It's out today. It's cool. I mean, I hope you know this. You know.
Is that true? Oh, wow, thanks for telling me.
It'd be amazing if you wrote a book without realising it.
The Red Apprentice, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, The Making of Manchester United's Great Hope. What's it about? Now, obviously, I can put two and two together and work that out. But why did you want to write it?
Well, it's a biography of him, some sort of cradle, if I can put it that way, to now. Obviously, Manchester United as a player and now manager is a massive part of that story. Why did I write it? Well, there's never been, if I can put it this way, a sort of definitive one. There are some books about him, but they're not really what I would call an exhaustive biography. Got a good story. I mean, to write about, you know, as a writer, as I'm sure we'll all agree, it's great to have something to go at. And with Solskjaer, whatever you think about him as a manager, etc., his story is a bit of a fairy tale, both as a player and now as a manager. Difficult to remember now, but hopefully some of the book recaptures some of this. When he came into United as the caretaker, there was a little bit, it was a bit like when he signed actually for United as a player. It was like, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is going to be a caretaker manager. United having a caretaker manager, and they've chosen Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. It was a little bit like when he signed. He was part of a group of five who went there summer 96 after the Euros. Poborski, Karol Poborski, Raymond van der Hau, Ronnie Johnson, and Jordi Cruyff. And who was this sort of 23, 22-year-old? Great subject. You know, I really enjoyed it. I spoke to over 40 or 50 people for the book. It was a sort of... You know, I was discovering as I went along about the gentleman. So, yeah, I found him quite easy to write about because there is a lot of story there.
Sure. And how interesting a man is he? Because he sort of seems like quite a nice man, but
yeah,
you don't see a lot that makes you instantly think I'm desperate to learn about this guy. But that might be quite a sort of superficial view that we have of him from the outside.
I know what you mean, but actually when I started digging, there is a lot of story there. So when I say that, I mean there's a lot of arcs, you know, sort of narrative twists and turns. I think he's an intriguing character because he's a lot smarter than maybe some people consider. He's a lot steelier. You know, he's definitely a tough nut. He's not. And also one thing about him, and maybe the most striking thing is he's very, very self-aware, self-reflexive, reads himself very well, and so therefore can read other people as smartly, which I think when you're into management, man, you know, for me, managers, top of the game, any level really, but when we're talking about elite level, the thing they have to have, they cannot get anywhere without, is man management. And I mean good, slick, you know, these players will run through, I know it's a cliche, but run through the wall. Klopp's got it, Mourinho had it the first time at Chelsea, you know, Brian Clough had it, we could go through the wall, and I think Solskjaer's definitely got that. And why I say that is because that's what I was being told. Even players, say at Cardiff, where they went, you know, he oversaw a relegation, love him as a man, as a manager, respect him. I think that's what you're seeing now with these players. You know, they got hammered 6-1, I was at that game, by Spurs. What a joke of a performance that was. But then they bounced back since, 4 unbeaten. I know Chelsea wasn't a great display, but it was still a draw. They didn't get beaten. And I think, you know, there's something to be said for what he has. I give him easily, by a country mile, the best chance. And I know it's because he's in the job now, but I mean, of any manager since Ferguson left. So Mourinho, Van Gaal, Moyes, he didn't have this kind of thing I'm alluding to, which is a bit of an X factor, his own particular X factor.
At one point in the book, Jamie, actually, it's interesting you say that, because at one point in the book you say, Ollie is seeing the big picture, taking the long view of where his team should be. Do you think his critics are not seeing the big picture?
Probably not, but I have empathy, or I can understand with critics, because they're not in the big picture. They're not seeing what, you know. We all know that managers, public figures, footballers can't always say the truth or everything they want to say in public for all kinds of reasons. So I understand the criticism. You know, how many of those critics are sort of delving into his life like I was? So I was sort of party to information and sort of history, his history, actual facts that have occurred that allowed me to sort of maybe see it differently. But of course, all that's holcomb if you lose 10 games in a row, forget about it. So he still had to perform. But he has got a vision. I think it's easy to say now, but it's in the book, so I was writing it at the time. I do think he is tactically smart. He got the first PSG game completely right. Yeah, and that was what I remember. That was a few months into his. There was a game at Spurs actually before that where he played. I think he played Lingard as a false number nine, and you know, he beat Pochettino's Spurs at Wembley as it was then, 1-0. You know, so I can give you all sorts of examples where. But at the same time, I fully understand, expect, and quite enjoy when you know you get a counter view and say, well, actually, what about this performance? Sport's very difficult. You live or die by results. You know, you are. I would say you're always good as your next win rather than your last one. And so, you know, I can say all this and they might get walloped on Sunday when Arsenal are in town. You just that's sport for you. But I do think, and I'll tell you the other thing that I like about this story. I think it's refreshing that United have stuck with him. Now, again, naysayers might say, well, he's perfect for them. You know, he's a bit of a yes man, which he isn't. But that might be you know, the reason why the Glazers haven't sacked him. But no, they've actually invested some time. They could have pulled the trigger, you know, three or four times, and they haven't done. And so maybe, you know, you'll see United starting to actually soar on a consistent basis.
Has the book been translated into Norwegian?
It hasn't, but we have got a deal in Vietnam and I believe Japan. So Norway, why not?
Well, I say that because, Lars, we've spoken about it before, but you can't really underestimate how he's viewed in Norway, can you?
Yeah, no, he's obviously a massive figure. Though, of course, there has been a slight backlash. I think there's been some, in recent years, some negative stories in the press about his agent in particular and his relationship with his agent. That's come under a lot of scrutiny. I don't know to what extent you go into that in the book, Jamie. But another thing I want to put to you very quickly, Jamie, is that I think the most prevalent criticism of Solskjaer, perhaps, is that he's someone who, with his managerial CV, shouldn't be near the Man United job in the first place. Like anyone who's not Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, whose CV reads, you know, done all right in Norway or done well in Norway and got relegated with Cardiff, like you're not getting the Man United job under any circumstance, and that he's just fundamentally underqualified to begin with. That's the thing that comes up every time they lose a game. Now, I wonder, as someone who's really taken a deep dive and spoken to people who know him and all this sort of stuff that you've done, what have you learned very briefly that's made you, you know, to counter that? Because you seem to feel very differently.
So there's two things there. First of all, you know, this thing about, well, he wouldn't be in the job if he wasn't Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. But that's kind of half the point. He is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. He understood the club. He scored that goal. He was there under Ferguson as a player, I think, 11 years and 3 years as a sort of coach, reserve team manager coach. So he did have some, you know, a bit of coaching experience at United. Now, at that moment, if you start to think about it, it was actually quite a perfect appointment at that moment if you're going to get a caretaker in. Secondly of all, I'd suggest there's a chapter in the book about Cardiff, and one of the players there, a player called Ben Turner, basically says at quite length that he was called into his office ahead of a game in February 2014 and was told by Solskjaer face-to-face that he'd been told he had to drop him for another player, a player called Juan Cala. Now, you know, if you start to consider that, you know, he wasn't always able to choose the players he wanted. I'm not saying that's the only reason or the reason why Cardiff went down, but it does throw up maybe or give a different perspective. And this is the whole point about, you know, when you look into stuff at length, maybe, you know, you sort of start to sort of understand different things. And again, about that part of the book, the player Ben Turner really respected the fact that he was being told face to face, look, I can't pick you. You know, that's what he brought out of that experience when he was talking to me about it. You know, I think he uses the word integrity, straight, honesty, more than one, saying how much more straighter can you be than being told face to face, look, I can't pick you. He didn't have to do that, Solskjaer. You know, he didn't have to tell him. He could have just dropped him. And again, I think that's a feather in Solskjaer's cap, because that shows the kind of man, stroke manager, he is. You know, a terrible time. That they're going down, it's a nightmare for him, it's his dream of managing the Premier League, and yet he still had this principle, this way of handling himself and his operation, I think, in a good way.
Oh, I want him to be a huge success now. That's how easy my mind is.
Did you not before then, Max?
Do you know what? I think what you said about him being a nice bloke, I totally agree. I don't know, within football, but within everything, it's sort of underrated skill, or not even skill, just trait that, you know, nice people, why can't they just do, you know, be granted success? Barry, sorry, but before I got all trite and wishy-washy, you wanted to ask a question.
Well, I'm just wondering, Jamie, how terrified were you he would be sacked before the book came out? And if he had been, would it have been binned off, and would you have got to keep your advance?
Right, it's interesting. This is the thing that comes up all the time. I've got quite a good way of answering this. So basically, terrified is not the right word, but of course, it's how can I say, it's not going to be great for sales or attraction. You know, if the guy you're writing about being billed as their great hope is, you know, no longer out there. But interesting sort of footnote to this. So originally the book should have been out summer 2019. So let's say July 2019. Now, as I just mentioned, I signed the deal. They'd just beaten PSG, all was rosy. And they started to go like that, like seriously, like I think they only won three of the last 14 games. Now, part of my deal, so I got I'll have to say, quite a generous lump sum that wouldn't be affected by anything if he got sacked. But I also got, again, quite a nice extra payment if they finished in the Champions League places, right?
Wow.
And when I signed the deal, it looked like they were an absolute shoo-in for third, yeah? You know, there's no way they weren't going to finish third. They ended up finishing sixth, I think, and I was absolutely like, wow. But then they put the book publication date back a year. my agent sort of revived the clause that I just mentioned. And of course, he finished third on the final day. So, you know, all's well that ends well.
You got the biggest win bonus out of all. The person who got the biggest Champions League bonus. Oh, that's great. Okay, well, good luck with the book.
Thank you.
And it's called The Red Apprentice. Out now. Go and buy it. Premier League preview. Friday, Wolves play Palace. Saturday, Sheffield United, Man City's the early game. Burnley, Chelsea at 3. Liverpool, West Ham at 5:30. Philip says, with Fabinho saying he could play on with his hamstring injury, quote, just no sprints. How long could you all carry on with a hamstring gone? Can Barry run? I seem to remember, Barry, you speculating some time ago whether you actually had any hamstrings.
Well, I'll tell you something. I never really before been aware of having hamstrings, but in recent weeks, I've been doing an awful lot of walking, sometimes up to 7 miles a day. And if there was one stage, I think I'd gone on 3 very long walks in 3 successive days, and I woke up the day after, and I tell you something, I knew all about my hamstrings after that.
Sunday, Villa, Southampton, Newcastle, Everton, Man United, Arsenal, Spurs play Brighton. The shit game, 5:30 Monday afternoon, pointless, and the chase also on air at the same time is Fulham, West Brom, and Leeds, Leicester is the Monday night game. Ian says, not a question, a massive shout out to @BridBantam and all the Bradford City fans who have donated their hard-earned cash this week to Tunbridge Angels in lieu of gate money my hometown club would have received at next week's FA Cup tie. Wonderful idea, brilliantly supported. We echo that. That's a lovely gesture.
Could I also say, Max, just before we go, yeah. I'd like to thank everyone who had such nice things to say about Kevin McCara in the comments section under the pod and on Twitter. He seemed to have been really appreciated and admired by a lot of our listeners and Guardian readers.
Oh yeah, absolutely. How now, Barry, do I do a gear change into the EFL trophy being known as the Papa John's trophy?
I think Kevin would approve of any gear change you like.
So there it is. Somebody said Barry needs a new box. Yeah. It's not the Carabao Cup, though. This is the EFL trophy, isn't it? This is the League One and League Two one. Will now be known as the Papa John's trophy.
It's just a stonking night in to have both of those. You can get a Papa John's, yeah, wash it down with several tins of Carabao, and then never sleep again.
Finally, Patrick says, I remember you all ripping into Ted Lasso when the admittedly awful trailer came out. Actually ended up being quite good. Did anyone on the pod give it a chance? Do you know what? I keep meaning to bring this up. We got a few people being very angry with us for being rude about Ted Lasso, despite the fact none of us had seen it, which is probably entirely fair. And apparently it is really good. I'm yet to watch it, but it does include inverting the pyramid. So like, we should congratulate it for that, but don't tell Wilson.
Did Wilson get money from that? Because I'm sure he would have explored that avenue.
I don't think he was on a Ted Lasso. If Ted Lasso gets into the Champions League, does Jonathan Wilson get a Jamie Jackson-sized bonus? That's the question. Anyway, at some point, we'll all watch Ted Lasso and review it properly. And we didn't deserve to be so rude about something. We can't criticize people who haven't listened to the pod but criticize it and then go on and criticize a TV show we haven't watched. We are the biggest hypocrites of all. And that'll do for today's podcast. Hey, Barry, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you very much.
Come back on again when you're peddling something else, why don't you?
Please do. Please do.
And Lars Sivertsen, thank you.
Thanks, Max.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.